All right, so we're diving into the world of life and health insurance today, and we've got some excerpts from a textbook chapter called Life Chapter 1, General Life and Health.pdf to help us unpack the fundamentals. But don't worry, we're not going to bore you with, textbook readings.
Yeah, think of us as your guides through this dense material. We'll help you cut through all the jargon and find those nuggets of knowledge that are actually relevant to you.
Okay, cool. So one of the first things that really struck me in this chapter was the concept of risk transfer. It's almost like a weight off your shoulders, isn't it? Knowing that you're not alone in shouldering the what-ifs of life.
Absolutely. It's fascinating how insurance provides that peace of mind by allowing you to transfer those potential burdens. And the textbook does a good job of breaking down risk into two main categories: pure risk and speculative risk.
Yeah, I remember reading about that. So pure risk is like the chance of getting into a car accident. Something you can't really control. But speculative risk is more like investing in the stock market or buying a lottery ticket. There's a chance you could win big, but you could also lose.
Exactly. And that's a key distinction because insurance only deals with pure risk. You can't insure your dreams of winning the lottery, but you can protect yourself financially from the potential fallout of an accident.
That makes sense. So let's say I have car insurance. How does risk transfer actually work in that scenario?
Well, when you buy car insurance, you're essentially transferring the risk of a potential financial loss from an accident to the insurance company. You pay a premium, a relatively small and predictable amount, and in return, the insurance company agrees to cover the cost of repairs or medical bills, which could be much larger and totally unpredictable.
So it's like a safety net. But I'm curious about something. The textbook also mentions this thing called exposure. It seemed a bit technical. How does that fit into the whole picture?
Good question. Exposure is basically a way for insurance companies to measure the potential for loss. It's expressed in units, for example, in life insurance. The unit of exposure is typically $1,000 of death benefit. So if you have a $100,000 life insurance policy, your exposure would be 100 units.
Okay, so it's like a way to quantify the
Sure.
risk, right? And does that then tie into how premiums are calculated?
Absolutely. The chapter uses an example where the life insurance rate is $32 per $1,000 of death benefit. So for your $100,000 policy or 100 units of exposure, the annual premium would be $3,200. It's all about assessing the level of risk and then determining a fair price for taking on that risk.
Okay, I'm starting to see how it all connects, but before we move on, there's something else from the chapter that I wanted to clarify: perils and hazards. I always thought those words were interchangeable, but the textbook makes a clear distinction between them.
Right. They're definitely not the same thing. A peril is the actual cause of a loss, like a fire that destroys a house, or in the case of life insurance, death. A hazard, on the other hand, is something that increases the chance of that peril happening.
Okay, so a hazard is like a contributing factor. I remember the textbook used a really interesting analogy to explain this. Could you remind me what that was?
Sure. They compared it to parenting a child. Imagine a child climbing on something dangerous. The parent might say, "Get down from there before you get hurt." The potential for injury in this case is the peril, but the child's climbing, the action that increases the chance of injury, is the hazard.
That's a great analogy. It really makes it click. And it reminds me, the chapter also talks about different types of hazards, like physical hazards, moral hazards, and morale hazards. What are some examples of those?
The physical hazard could be something like a heart condition that increases the risk of death. A moral hazard might involve dishonesty or fraud, actions that could lead to a claim. And a morale hazard, sometimes called the idiot hazard, relates to carelessness or indifference to risk, like leaving your doors unlocked or not wearing a seatbelt.
Wow, it seems like insurance companies have a lot to consider when assessing risks. So how do they actually manage all these different factors?
That's where the STAR methods come in: sharing, transfer, avoidance, reduction, and retention.
Right, I remember reading about that in the chapter. Could you give me an example of each of these methods?
Sure, sharing risk could involve a group of businesses pooling their resources to cover potential losses. Transfer, as we discussed earlier, is the foundation of insurance. Avoidance is pretty straightforward. If you don't want to die in a plane crash, don't get on an airplane. Reduction involves taking steps to minimize risk, like installing a security system in your home. And retention means accepting the risk and bearing the potential loss yourself, like choosing a high deductible to lower your insurance premiums.
It's amazing how these different approaches can be used to manage various types of risks, but I'm curious, can everything be insured? Are there any limits to what insurance companies will cover?
You're right, not everything can be insured. The textbook outlines six characteristics of insurable risk. One of the key factors is that the risk must be non-catastrophic. Events like war or widespread natural disasters are typically considered uninsurable because the potential losses are just too massive for any single company to handle.
So insurance companies aren't invincible, even though they deal with risk every day. And there's another concept in the chapter that I found intriguing, adverse selection. Can you explain what that means and why it's a concern for insurance companies?
Imagine if only people who were about to get sick signed up for health insurance. That's the basic idea behind adverse selection. It's the tendency for people who are higher risk to seek insurance more often. Mm. If insurance companies don't manage this carefully, it can create a situation where their costs outweigh the premiums they collect, making the business unsustainable.
That makes sense. So how do insurance companies protect themselves from adverse selection?
They use a process called underwriting. This is basically a thorough evaluation of the risk involved. They'll look at your health history, lifestyle, occupation, and other factors to determine your level of risk and then decide whether to insure you and what premium to charge.
So it's a way for them to make sure they're not taking on too much risk. Now let's talk about the players in the insurance world. The textbook mentions different types of insurance companies like stock insurers and mutual insurers. What's the difference between those?
Stock insurers are owned by stockholders, and their main goal is to make a profit for those investors. Mutual insurers, on the other hand, are owned by their policyholders. Any profits they make are often returned to the policyholders as dividends.
Interesting. So in a way, with a mutual company, you're not just a customer, you're also a part owner.
That's a good way to put it. And then you have these fascinating organizations called Lloyd's Associations. They're not actually insurance companies themselves, but rather groups of individuals who come together to share and spread risk. They're known for insuring all sorts of unusual things, even celebrity body parts.
That's wild. I guess that goes to show just how diverse and far-reaching the world of insurance can be. But let's get back to the more practical side of things. The chapter also talks about agents, those individuals who help people connect with insurance companies. Can you break down the different types of agents and how they operate?
Of course, you have independent agents who work with multiple insurance companies, giving you a wider range of choices. Then there are exclusive agents who represent just one specific company. And finally, you have direct rating companies that cut out the agent altogether, allowing you to purchase insurance directly online or over the phone.
It sounds like there are a lot of options to choose from, but how do you know who to trust in this whole process? The chapter emphasizes the importance of fiduciary responsibility. What does that mean in the context of insurance?
It means that the agent has a legal obligation to act in your best interest, not just the insurance companies. They are bound to recommend products that are suitable for your specific needs and to disclose all relevant information honestly and transparently.
So no shady dealings, no pushing policies that aren't a good fit, right?
Exactly. Transparency and honesty are paramount in this relationship. And it's also important to be aware of something called commingling, which is a big no-no in the insurance world. This is when an agent mixes your money with their personal funds, which is a serious ethical breach.
Yikes, that sounds like a recipe for disaster.
Mm.
So as a consumer, how can you ensure that you're working with an ethical and trustworthy agent?
It's essential to do your research, ask questions, and understand the different types of agent authority. The chapter outlines three types: express, implied, and apparent authority. Express authority is clearly defined in the agent's contract, with the insurance company outlining what they can and cannot do. Implied authority isn't explicitly stated, but is considered necessary for the agent to carry out their duties effectively, such as accepting premium payments. And apparent authority is what others believe the agent has the power to do based on their actions or representations, even if it's not actually true.
Okay, I'm starting to feel like I need a law degree to understand all this, but seriously, it's important to be aware of these details because at the end of the day, insurance boils down to a contract, and contracts have legal implications.
You're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. The chapter conveniently uses the acronym COAL to break down the elements of a legal contract: consideration, offer, acceptance, and legal purpose.
So in an insurance contract, my consideration would be the premium I pay and the information I provide, and the insurer's consideration is their promise to pay for covered losses.
Precisely. And it's important to remember that insurance contracts have unique characteristics. They are contracts of adhesion, meaning the insured has to accept the terms as written by the insurer. They're also aleatory, which means that the value each party receives from the contract might not be equal.
Ah, so that explains why I might pay premiums for years and never make a claim, while someone else could file a huge claim after just one premium payment. It all comes down to that element of chance, right?
Exactly. It's that element of uncertainty that makes insurance a unique type of contract.
Yeah.
And speaking of uncertainty, the chapter also stresses the importance of good faith in insurance contracts. Do you elaborate on that?
Sure. The principle of utmost good faith means that both parties, the insured and the insurer, are expected to be truthful and transparent throughout the process. This is where the concepts of misrepresentation, concealment, and fraud become critical.
Right. Misrepresenting information, concealing crucial facts, or intentionally deceiving the insurer can all have serious consequences, potentially voiding the policy and even leading to legal action.
So honesty is truly the best policy when it comes to insurance. But what about those situations where an insurance company seems to bend the rules or overlook certain requirements? The chapter mentions waiver and estoppel in this context. Can you shed some light on those concepts?
Of course. Waiver is when the insurance company intentionally gives up a known right. For example, if they consistently accept late premium payments without penalty, they might be considered to have waived their right to cancel the policy due to late payments in the future. Estoppel, on the other hand, prevents the company from denying an action they previously accepted, even if it goes against their standard practices.
So it's like saying they can't go back on their word, even if they technically have the right to do so.
Exactly. It's all about consistency and fairness in their dealings with policyholders.
This has been incredibly insightful. We've covered so much ground already, from the basics of risk and insurance to the complexities of contracts and agent authority. It's like putting together a puzzle, and each piece of information helps to create a clearer picture of how the insurance world operates.
And we've only just scratched the surface. There are many more fascinating aspects to explore.
Absolutely. But before we dive into those, I think it's a good point to pause and reflect on what we've learned so far.
I agree. It's important to take a moment to process this information and see how it all connects.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground, you know, understanding how insurance works, the different types of companies, and even the legal side of things with contracts and agents. But let's shift gears a bit and talk about how you actually get insurance. It's not exactly a topic that comes up at parties, right?
Well, maybe for some. But you're right, for most people, it's not exactly dinner party conversation. But understanding the different ways insurance is marketed and sold can be really helpful when you're looking for coverage.
Right, because you want to make sure you're getting the best deal and the right policy for your needs. The chapter mentions agents and direct response marketing. Can you explain the difference between those two approaches?
Think of it like this. Imagine you're shopping for clothes. You could go to a department store and work with a personal shopper who helps you find the perfect outfit that's kind of like working with an agent. Or you could browse online and order something directly from a website that's similar to direct response marketing and insurance. Both have their pros and cons.
So with an agent, you get that personalized advice and someone to answer your questions. But with direct response, you might have more control and potentially save some money.
That's a good way to summarize it. But even within the agent world, there are different types to be aware of. The chapter talks about independent agents, exclusive agents, and general agents. I remember always getting those confused.
Me too. It can be a bit overwhelming trying to keep them all straight. Can you break it down for us?
Absolutely. Independent agents are like free agents in sports. They can work with multiple insurance companies and offer you a wider selection of policies from different providers.
So they're not tied to any one company's products.
Right. It's like having a one-stop shop where you can compare different options. Then you have exclusive agents who are committed to one specific insurance company.
So it's like they're on that company's team.
Exactly. They're experts in that company's products and services. And then you have virtual agents who are kind of like team managers. They oversee a network of other agents, often providing training and support.
Okay, that actually makes a lot more sense now. But why is it so important to understand these different types of agents and their roles?
Because as we talked about earlier, agents have different levels of authority. And that can impact your experience as a consumer. You want to be sure you're working with someone who has the knowledge and expertise to help you find the right coverage and who's acting in your best interests.
You mentioned agent authority earlier, and I remember the chapter highlighted express, implied, and apparent authority. Can we revisit those definitions and why they matter?
Of course, express authority is the most straightforward. It's the authority that's explicitly granted to the agent in their contract with the insurance company. It outlines exactly what they're allowed to do, like what types of policies they can sell or what changes they can make to a policy.
So it's all clearly spelled out in black and white.
Right. Then you have implied authority, which is a bit more nuanced. It's not explicitly stated, but it's considered necessary for the agent to carry out their duties effectively.
So, for example, if an agent's contract doesn't specifically say they can collect premium payments, but that's a common practice in their role, that could be considered implied authority.
Exactly. And then there's apparent authority, which can be the trickiest to navigate. It's the authority that a third party reasonably believes the agent has, based on the agent's actions or representations, even if it's not actually true.
So, for instance, if an agent promises something that's outside of their actual authority, but it seems reasonable for the customer to believe them, the insurance company might still be held responsible.
That's right. It can create some sticky situations, which is why it's important for both agents and consumers to be very clear about the scope of the agent's authority.
It all underscores the fact that insurance is more than just picking a policy and paying your premium. There's a whole legal framework behind it based on contracts and the responsibilities of the parties involved.
Absolutely. And the chapter does a good job of highlighting the key elements of an insurance contract using the acronym COAL in consideration, offer acceptance, and legal purpose. It's helpful to remember that these elements are the foundation of any legal contract, not just those related to insurance.
Right. It's like those fundamental building blocks that apply across different areas of law. But insurance contracts also have some unique characteristics, don't they?
Yes, they do. One important characteristic is that they're contracts of adhesion, which means the insured has to accept the terms as written by the insurer. There's not really room for negotiation.
So it's kind of a take it or leave it situation.
In a way, yes. That's why it's so crucial to read the policy carefully and understand what you're agreeing to before you sign on the dotted line. Another distinctive feature of insurance contracts is their aleatory nature.
That sounds a bit complicated. Can you explain what that means?
It means that the value each party receives from the contract might be unequal. For example, you might pay premiums for years without ever making a claim, while someone else might receive a large payout shortly after purchasing a policy.
So it all comes down to that element of chance and uncertainty, right?
Precisely. That's what makes insurance so unique. You're essentially paying for protection against the unknown. And that brings us back to the principle of utmost good faith, which we discussed earlier. Both the insured and the insurer have a responsibility to be honest and transparent with each other.
Right, because trust is really at the heart of the insurance relationship. You're relying on the insurance company to be there for you when you need them, and they're relying on you to provide accurate information and act in good faith.
Exactly. And that's where the concepts of misrepresentation, concealment, and fraud come into play. These are serious offenses that can have significant consequences, potentially leading to the voiding of a policy or even legal action.
So it's not just about being honest. It's about being incredibly thorough and making sure you understand everything in the contract.
That's a good point. It's always best to err on the side of caution and disclose any information that you think might be relevant, even if you're not sure.
Now, what about those situations where an insurance company might seem to overlook certain rules or requirements? I remember the chapter mentioned waivers and estoppel set. Could you refresh our memories on how those concepts work and why they're important?
Sure. A waiver is when an insurance company voluntarily gives up a known right. For example, if they have a history of accepting late premium payments without penalty, they might be considered to have waived their right to cancel the policy for future late payments.
So it's like they've established a pattern of leniency.
Right. And estoppel is a bit similar. It prevents an insurance company from denying something they previously accepted, even if it goes against their usual practices.
So it's about holding them accountable for their actions and preventing them from suddenly changing the rules on you.
Exactly. Both waiver and estoppel are important safeguards that protect policyholders from unfair or inconsistent treatment by insurance companies.
Wow, this deep dive is really shedding light on the intricate workings of the insurance world. I feel like we're starting to see the bigger picture, how all these pieces fit together.
I agree. We've covered a lot of ground, but it's all essential knowledge for anyone who wants to navigate the world of insurance with confidence.
And I think it's amazing how the textbook chapter we're using manages to pack so much information into a relatively short space.
It's a testament to the complexity of this industry. And while we focused on the fundamentals, there are always deeper layers to explore.
Speaking of deeper layers, I remember the chapter touched on a couple of topics that we haven't really discussed yet. Reinsurance and the financial stability of insurance companies. Those seem pretty important.
They are absolutely crucial. It's one thing to understand the terms of an insurance policy, but it's equally important to note that the company backing that policy is financially sound and capable of fulfilling its promises.
Right, because what good is a policy if the insurance company goes belly up when you need them the most? The chapter mentions something about financial ratings for insurance companies. What are those and why should we care?
That's a great question. It's like checking a company's credit score before you do business with them. There are independent agencies like AM Best Standard & Poor's and Moody's that evaluate the financial strength of insurance companies. They look at factors like their claims history, investment performance, and management practices to assign ratings that reflect their ability to meet their financial obligations.
So it's like a measure of how trustworthy and reliable they are. Is there somewhere we can go to find those ratings?
Absolutely. These ratings are publicly available, and you can usually find them on the rating agency's websites or even on the insurance company's own website. It's definitely a good idea to do your homework and check those ratings before you commit to a policy. It's all about peace of mind, knowing that the company you're entrusting your financial security to is in good shape.
That's a really helpful tip. I'm definitely going to be checking those ratings from now on. Now, the chapter also briefly mentions reinsurance, which, if I remember correctly, is basically insurance for insurance companies, right?
That's a great way to put it. It might sound a bit strange at first, but it's actually a very important part of the insurance ecosystem. Essentially, reinsurance allows insurance companies to spread the risk they're taking on by transferring a portion of it to another insurer called the reinsurer.
So it's like a safety net for the insurance industry, helping to ensure that even if a major catastrophe happens, they can still pay out claims to policyholders.
Exactly. Reinsurance allows insurance companies to manage their overall risk exposure and avoid potentially devastating financial losses, especially from those large-scale events that could wipe out a smaller insurer. It's a fascinating system that really highlights the interconnectedness of the financial world.
It's really amazing how all of these pieces fit together, from individual policyholders to insurance companies to reinsurers. It's a complex web of risk management and financial interdependence.
It really is. And that's why understanding the basics is so empowering. It allows you to see beyond the jargon and appreciate the intricacies of an industry that impacts so many aspects of our lives.
I totally agree. And I have to say, this deep dive has been incredibly eye-opening. We've gone from the fundamental concepts of risk and insurance to the legal aspects of contracts and agent authority. And now we're even talking about the financial stability of insurance companies and this fascinating world of reinsurance.
It's been quite a journey. And I think those analogies we discussed along the way really helped to make these sometimes abstract concepts more concrete and relatable. Remember the lottery ticket for speculative risk, or comparing parenting to understanding hazards.
Those were brilliant. They really brought the textbook to life and made the information much easier to digest and remember.
And that's always our goal here on The Deep Dive, to make complex topics accessible and engaging, to spark curiosity and equip our listeners with the knowledge they need to make informed decisions.
So for our listener who's been with us on this deep dive into life and health insurance, remember that knowledge is power. The more you understand about how insurance works, the better equipped you'll be to protect your financial well-being and make choices that align with your needs and goals.
Absolutely. Keep asking questions, stay curious, and never stop learning. The world of insurance is vast and constantly evolving, but with a solid foundation of knowledge, you can navigate it with confidence.
That's a fantastic note to end on. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the world of life and health insurance. We'll see you next time for another fascinating exploration of knowledge.